Can't stop my heart from loving you. But though you treat me badly and make me blue, I try and try, I really do. But I just can't stop my heart from loving you. I tell myself stop my heart from loving you. Though you treat me badly and make me blue, I try and try, I really do. But I just can't stop my heart from loving you.
Oh, tell me why, oh why can't I leave? What kind of hold do you have on me?
Can't stop my heart from loving you. Though you treat me badly and make me blue, I try and try, I really do. But I just can't stop my heart from loving you.
If you love somebody enough, you'll follow wherever they go. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. If you love somebody enough, you'll go where your heart wants to go. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. I know if you've seen her, you tell me, 'cause you are my friend. I've got to find her and find out the trouble she's in. If you tell me that she's not here, I'll follow the trail of her tears. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. She would get mad and she used to say that she'd come back to Memphis someday. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. I haven't eaten a bite or slept for 3 days and nights. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis. Well, I've got to find her and tell her that I love her so. I'll never rest till I find out why she had to go. Thank you for your precious time. Forgive me if I start to cry. That's how I got to Memphis. 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 That's how I got to Memphis.
Hey, kids. It's Krusty the Clown. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. All right, where's my money? What? Chintzy College Station.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
A handful of rare audio recordings of interviews conducted with formerly enslaved Black Americans is shedding new light on the brutality of slavery and racial injustice in America.
Yeah, and ABC's Alex Perche learned more about these recordings from two key scholars of the ambitious 10 Million Names Project. And a warning here, of course, the subject matter is upsetting.
I want you to tell me how you got your name.
I got my name from President Jeff Davis. He was President of the Southern Confederacy. He owned my grandfather and my father. My grandfather was a blacksmith, and my father had learned how to write a little bit in Richmond, Virginia before he brought him down here.
You're listening to the voice of a formerly enslaved American, a man by the name of George Johnson. This rare and historic audio interview was recorded in 1941, almost 80 years after Mr. Johnson gained his freedom. He and his family worked on a plantation in Virginia owned by Confederate leader Jefferson Davis, a staunch opponent of abolition. In the interview, Johnson recalls a day in the life as an enslaved person.
Did they drive the slaves down there and Davis has been very hard, or did they work them reasonable?
Reasonable. You know, Master Jewel gave myself another boy. And the boy was chopping cotton. Boy didn't kill for the gang, you understand? He come to hook the boy kill, you understand? That's the house of Master Jewel boy. And that's what's the trouble, son. Say, Mr. Someone won't hook me because I don't kill for the gang.
Audio tape interviews like this are striking and uncommon, but are actually part of a long legacy of Black families, communities, and institutions, including historically Black colleges and universities, that lead the way in collecting and preserving the oral histories of the formerly enslaved people in the 19th and 20th centuries. In the 1930s and beyond, technology allowed some of these interviews to be recorded as part of both federal and independent projects.
Do we know roughly like how many of these recordings exist?
The recordings are relatively rare, but the recordings come from a much larger and really important and in many ways unsung collecting effort.
In 1974, a woman named Celia Black, at the age of 114 years old and shortly before her death, recalled picking cotton in Texas as a child born into slavery.
I didn't have to pick cotton or nothing.
I've been doing nothing but like in the field. Wet in the field, oh goodness. Me and my husband would go, I'd west and pick cotton. Go out west every year. We've been this year going out there picking cotton.
One of the things that kind of struck me when you have an interview recorded in 1974, for some Black Americans, I mean, they're one generation removed from slavery.
In some ways, we think of slavery as ancient history. We think of it as something that happened a very long time ago to people we couldn't possibly have known.
Dr. Kendra Field, chief historian of the 10 Million Names Project, and Harvard professor Vincent Brown explained how these recordings illustrate an enormous preservation effort, the firsthand accounts shedding light on the darkest chapters in our American history, yet also revealing incredible African-American strength and survival.
Didn't you have some entertainment doing a dancing or anything?
Oh, I used to dance. But I don't do it now. No, I don't dance now. I try my best to serve my master. I'm trying my best to serve my heavenly father.
You hear these recordings. What were the emotions when you hear, you know, the recollections of Celia Black?
First is just the miracle of her survival. It's just that I'm actually hearing this person who had been enslaved. That's kind of a miracle.
With the help of the 10 Million Names genealogist, we were able to find the direct descendants of Celia Black.
Yeah.
In Rhode Island, we met 68-year-old Curtis Royal, who spent time with her as a young man.
She's my great-grandmother.
from my mother's side of the family.
Do you remember any of the stories that she would tell?
She told us about how difficult it was, you know, just being alive during that period.
You had the chance to know your great-grandmother.
Yes.
How powerful is it being able to connect that dot?
It's extremely powerful. You got to hear it from her directly. Not something that was passed on, but to hear it directly from her. Her pain.
Wow, that firsthand testimony.
Unbelievable. And I don't need to tell you, those firsthand accounts are just so important in connecting us to all of our ancestors and our collective American history. Of course, thank you, Alex, for that moving report. But to hear those audio recordings.
And as they said, every voice is a miracle in that situation. And to learn more, scan the QR code on your screen to visit our newly launched ABC News 10 Million Names digital landing page.
400 years have passed since America's original sin, and still, riots are ignited in the friction between race and justice. As this debate continues, the Smithsonian is completing a monumental project, the $500 million National Museum of African American History and Culture. The idea was authorized by an act of Congress, which called it, quote, a tribute to the Negroes' contribution to the achievements of America. The words are jarring because the act was written in 1929. Building the museum has been a long struggle, just like the story it hopes to tell. Beside the monument to Washington, a slaveholding president, the museum is breaking free of the ground on the mall's last 5 acres. 8 decades after Congress framed a museum on paper and then failed to fund it, the dream is being written this time in steel and stone. 10 floors, 5 above ground, 5 below. Its complexion rendered in shades of bronze, a building of color against history's white marble.
You've been at this 9 years now. It's a big job.
Well, as I tell people, at 8 o'clock in the morning, I have the best job in America. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life. This is a Romare Bearden from the 1950s.
Sleepless nights are all in a day's work for the museum's founding director, Lonnie Bunch, a scholar of the 19th century.
Clearly, this ought to be one of those moments where people are going to sort of reflect, pause. What does it mean once we open? What does it mean in terms of development opportunities?
In 2003, President Bush signed the law creating the museum. Congress put up $250 million, and Bunch has raised most of another $250.
I knew that this is where this museum would have to be, that this is America's front lawn, and this is the place where people come to learn what it means to be an American, and this museum needs to be there.
So we're on the ground floor. This is where the visitors will come in. This will be their first experience in the museum. So what's going to be here?
They will walk in either from the mall or from Constitution Avenue, and they will run into amazing pieces of African-American art.
When all of this is finally complete, what will America have?
America will have a place that allows them to remember how much we as a country have been improved, changed, challenged, and made better by the African-American experience. They'll have a place that they can call home, but they'll also have a place that will make them change.
But even this place is only space until you fill it.
Oh my goodness. Now, did somebody already look at some of these things?
No.
7 years ago, the Smithsonian began rummaging the attics and basements of America.
This may have marked a milestone in his life, and what we don't know is what
but
that
But at least was. It gives me something that I can investigate.
3,000 people brought their family history to 16 Smithsonian events across the country.
And this is an early free black family based out of Baltimore.
Yes.
It sounds like Antiques Roadshow.
It is like Antiques Roadshow.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Elliott and Nancy Burkaw are curators.
We have experts from across the museum field, experts in conservation, experts who understand about paper, about metals, about you name it, fabrics, textiles. And they come in and they review objects for the public.
The coating on this is in pretty good condition.
Some of that looks like it's dried out a little bit.
And don't put it near the air conditioning unit because that'll dry it up too much.
How do you convince someone to give up a priceless family heirloom?
Do you know what our museum pitches itself? All we have to do is tell the absolute honest truth. People have been waiting for us. People in America have been waiting for this moment. And so literally they just hand us things.
And we're very excited like you are.
Thousands of relics were examined, but only 25 will be in the collection. This is one of them.
This was actually a connection we made with the family. Mr. Jesse Brooke was an enslaved man, and he was charged with playing this violin and entertaining the slaveholder and his guests.
This is the Smithsonian's warehouse in Maryland where the story is being written, and these are a few of the lines. Received by Grigsby E. Thomas, the sum of $350 in full payment for a Negro boy by the name of Jim, about 10 years old, this 31st day of December, 1835. Jim would have been familiar with these, shackles dating before 1860, bondage that might have been broken if the keeper of this Bible had succeeded in his bloody rebellion. Nat Turner had said that God commanded him to break the chains. His Bible was taken away before his execution. Paul Gardullo is a leader of the curating team.
I think many of us who know the story of slavery know about Nat Turner. Know about Nat Turner from the perspective of perhaps a freedom fighter, perhaps a murderer. Well, we know this is a religious person. We know this is a person who can read. And when you begin with that and those ideas, suddenly the person of Nat Turner and your understandings of Nat Turner take on a whole new light. And I look to do that again and again. Ways that we can see well-worn stories, stories we think we know, in a new light.
You may think you know the story of a boy murdered for whistling at a white woman until you're confronted with his casket.
The story of Emmett Till is a crucially important story in terms of what it tells us both about sort of reinvigorating the civil rights movement, but also it's a story of his mother, Mamie Mobley, who was really one of the most powerful people who said that her son's murder should not be in vain, that it should help to transform America.
No one was punished for the murder of Emmett Till. His body was exhumed in a later investigation, and the original casket was neglected.
But then the question was, would we ever display it? Should we ever display it? And I wrestled a lot with it. But then I realized I kept hearing Mamie Mobley in my head. And she said, I opened this casket to change the world, to make the world confront the dangers, the power, the ugliness of race in America.
A lot of the things that you intend to put on display are going to be hard to look at.
What I'm trying to do is find the right tension between moments of sadness and moments of resilience.
One resilient moment came out of the blue. Air Force Captain Matt Twy and his wife Tina rebuilt an old crop duster, and in curiosity, they sent the serial number to an Air Force historian.
And he said, are you sitting down? Because I have some news for you.
Turned out the 1944 Stearman had trained America's first black squadrons, the Tuskegee Airmen, who flew to fame in World War II.
I had never really known much about the Tuskegee Airmen. I'd seen the P-51 plane, but I'd never really truly understood what it meant.
Take your time.
Before donating the plane, known as a PT-13, the Quais carried the last of the airmen back to the air.
And it was just great to sit back in the back seat and look at this real Tuskegee Airman in a real Tuskegee airplane. It was just magical.
The greatest thrill in my life was sitting in the seat where you are and watching the ground drop off above me.
The
PT-13 was the baby we used to learn how to fly.
The Smithsonian collected the thoughts of Lieutenant Colonel Leo Gray in 2010.
And they said we couldn't fly, but we had the best record of any fighter group in the 15th Air Force and probably in the Air Force itself. We stayed with our bombers, we brought them home as best we could, and we proved that we could fly.
The story will continue after this.
Time is the enemy of history. So Smithsonian conservationists have been working for years restoring America's heritage from textiles to trains. This 1920 rail car had two sections, white and colored, the same number of seats, but colored was compressed in half the space. Physical, touchable, Jim Crow confinement, just like the guard tower from the prison in Angola, Louisiana, notorious for cruelty.
It's about 21 feet tall, and this is cast concrete, so it's an enormous object.
From monumental to minuscule, Carlos Bustamante is the project manager building a place for 33,000 moments in time.
So when you have the rail car pieces, the guard tower, and all the support equipment, we had a convoy of about 12 semi-trucks traveling down the road across six states to get here. And it took them about 3 days.
How do you get those things into this building?
So we set up two very, very large cranes. These cranes are rare. There's not a lot of them this size. And we picked up these two objects and basically brought them over the site and lowered them down about 60 feet below grade.
The answer is you don't move these objects into the building. You put these objects in place and you build the building around them.
Exactly. There's no other way.
Oftentimes what I'm drawn to are some of the smaller things. Shards of glass that were picked up after the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And it's finding the balance between the big and the small, Scott, that makes this work a challenge and so wonderful.
What is something that you desperately want and have not been able to find?
I want Willie Mays's mitt.
Which would be quite a catch to display along with Louis Armstrong's horn and Chuck Berry's horn behind the chrome of his 73 Cadillac. There's the welcome of Minton's Playhouse, which resonated to Miles, Monk, and Dizzy. Ali's headgear, pristine condition, and this fireman's headgear, a revolutionary invention in 1914 by mechanical genius Garrett Morgan.
Do you think the country's ready for this now?
I don't think America's ever ready to have the conversation around race based on what we see around the landscape, whether it's Ferguson or other places, that people are really ready to shine the light on all the dark corners of the American experience. But I hope this museum will help in a small way to do that.
This is not the American Museum of Slavery.
This is not the museum of tragedy. It is not the museum of difficult moments. It is the museum that says, here is a balanced history of America that allows us to cry and smile.
The drums evoked the power of spirit. You
musicians playing different rhythms at the same time resulted in a unique form of syncopation. Music making was communal. Call and response allowed for infinite individual expression and improvisation.
Singers draw from their emotions, experiences. So notions of joy, you may hear a screech, a howl. Feelings of sadness, you hear moans.
In African work songs, singing set the pace and reduced the monotony of work. This combination, dense textures, complex rhythms, and a community bound together by music while celebrating individual expression, is unique in the world. Over the course of three centuries, nearly 11 million enslaved Africans survived the brutal Atlantic crossing. Now bound but not broken, African music lived on in the souls of these people.
You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul.
Africans in America continued their African traditions.
Music is a part of a person's or a culture's identity. And music is not simply something you leave behind, it travels with you.
In the colonies of North America, the lives of Africans varied from region to region, and their music began to evolve in different ways. In the North, the enslaved population was sparser, often living singly or in small groups in the slaveholder's house or in nearby cabins. In these close quarters, the Africans were forbidden to use their traditional forms of religious expression.
The missionaries and other whites felt compelled to impose their own Christian views.
In Philadelphia, black worshipers founded their own church. They were now free to express spirituality in their own ways through music that came to be known as spirituals. In the Deep South, millions of enslaved Africans lived and labored on large farms and plantations, often isolated from white society. They used this distance to maintain distinct African rituals and their own unique forms of religious song. Across America, as the country changed, a revival movement known as the Second Great Awakening swept through rural and frontier America. Enslaved Africans were attracted to this movement with a style of preaching that encouraged free expression. In Louisiana, under French and Spanish rule, the mix of cultures was rich and more complex. New Orleans swirled French music and dance together with Caribbean, Spanish, Creole, and African. Free blacks and even enslaved Africans lived with more freedoms here. Musicians mingled. Conditions were setting up for a coming musical explosion. By this time, the United States had already abolished the importation of enslaved people. Without a constant influx of Africans bringing with them their traditional ways, Africans in America were becoming African American. In the 1860s, there were nearly 4 million enslaved people in the United States. This nation, founded on the ideal that all men are created equal, could no longer contain the contradiction. The Civil War brought an end to slavery and a new birth of freedom for a people and their music. The African roots of this music were now almost 250 years deep in America, roots that would transform the world's music. Following the Civil War and Reconstruction, hope for lasting change collapsed into a backlash of violence and legalized segregation in the South. and more subtle but entrenched racism and segregation in the North. At the crossroads of old hope and new realities emerged a wave of musical innovation. Black musicians began to travel the waterways and railways of America, and for the first time could find paid work as entertainers. With 90% of America's black population living in the South, cities upriver and further west became hotbeds of new music. Fiddlers and dance bands played on riverboats and in nightclubs, pianists in bars and saloons. Their music evolved from African-American song and dance and had an irresistible syncopated rhythm, often called ragging or ragtime. Ragtime was the first African-American music that would move beyond the black community to become wildly popular across the country. Ragtime was also one of the roots of early jazz.
Because early jazz, in a way, was like a sponge. It absorbed many different styles, ragtime, blues, hymns, popular dance music, marches, and turn those into the language or the style of early jazz. It just seemed to convert black New Orleans life into music, you know, and it was such a powerful force. Brass bands, of course, originated with European tradition, military bands, and the New Orleans jazz tradition teaches you how to look at that another way, how to reinterpret it. You can put bent tones in that, therefore you can bring Africa into the European march, you know? You can bring African-type rhythms or rhythms from ragtime. And certainly the music is greatly influenced and shaped by the dancers. It captured everything that went before and influenced everything that came after.
Across the Deep South, from the Mississippi Delta to the piney woods of East Texas, black musicians drew on singing styles used in field hollers, work songs, and early spirituals. A new sound rang out from front porches and street corners to juke joints and traveling tent shows. This was the birth of the blues.
So the blues to me is life. And you face it, it's like a mirror, and tell it like it is. A blues is happiness, blues is sad, blues is the truth, and blues can be a lie. Because if you say you don't like the blues, you probably don't like your mama. That's for all my friends.
In churches, folk spirituals, new hymns, the addition of instruments, and the sounds of jazz and blues converged into 20th century gospel.
Everybody has gone through something. Everybody is going through something. I'm speaking now from a spiritual standpoint. Dragging one foot and pushing the other, you're out. Those songs gave them that hope. It gave them that spiritual fortitude that it won't be this way always. I'm coming out of this. And so when you can sing gospel music and feel what you're singing, then somebody else is going to feel it. Because what comes from the heart reaches the heart.
Beginning in the late 1940s, charged with optimism and hope for change, the sounds of blues, jazz, spirituals, and gospel fueled the rise of a new music.
On Saturday night, my father would drive into town because the musicians would be on certain corners there playing the instruments. And all of those farmers, the black ones in particular, but you could see in the background the white ones, they would be in the background enjoying it all. But we didn't have genres. I don't know what to call that other than just phenomenal, rare singing and great music.
The music industry called it rhythm and blues, and eventually rock and roll.
what really cracked through and broke that wall for African-American music was the production and mixing concept of Berry Gordy and Motown Records.
Out of the full spectrum of African-American music would emerge soul, funk, disco, and Detroit techno. African roots continued to deepen. Hip-hop confronted and defied conditions and drew upon traditions of storytelling, rapping, rhyming, and preserving history through song.
I would notice when the breakdown part came, the bodies were gyrating more. And the great part was when the least band members played. So I created a system that allowed you to seamlessly go from a pop break to a rock break. And this was to service the breakdancers. The stars of the day was the breakdancers. So from there, it gave me a very small window of error. It makes it when whatever goes down, boom, it's another record. Now I can take a pretty short drum beat that was 10 seconds and make it 10 minutes seamlessly. Making this extended drum break allowed human beings to speak on it. Today they call it rap.
R&B, pop, gospel, and jazz artists incorporate hip-hop, electronic dance music, and coming full circle, music of the African diaspora. Pioneering new directions in black music across the 21st century and throughout the world.
Through the lived experience, we have a better understanding of how the music is situated in everyday life and why it is so distinctive to this group of people.
Jazz was the voice and spirit of the people. The music and its expression is like the ultimate metaphor for American democracy.
To sing the spiritual was to be free.
Blues had a baby, named it Jazz. Jazz had a baby, called it Rock and Roll.
Listen to your inner self. It's right. That's a gift.
Women's History Month, and unless you've been living under a rock, you've probably heard country music has gotten Beyoncified.
St. Texas, ain't no hold 'em. Hey. They are cards down, 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 down.
After their surprise release last month of two singles off of Beyoncé's upcoming album, Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, unsurprisingly, some folks weren't happy that this black woman superstar in the worlds of R&B and pop would venture into country, even though she is from Houston, Texas, literally. A small country music station in Oklahoma initially refused to play Texas Hold'em, but changed its tune after being inundated by the Beehive. Last week, Beyoncé became the first black woman to top Billboard's Hot Country chart and got the stamp of approval from the queen of country music herself, the great Dolly Parton, for doing so. The most Grammy-winning artist in history knows how to knock down barriers for herself. But Beyoncé is also giving some deserved shine to other black country and folk artists, like Rhiannon Giddens, who plays banjo on Texas Hold'em. Giddens wrote about the black roots of country music this week, reminding us enslaved people of the African diaspora created the banjo in the Caribbean in the 1600s. This is historical fact. The hype around Bey's new single is also amplifying the many black artists already in country music. It's the Beyoncé boost in streams for black women country artists, including a 275% increase. Wow. For a pioneer of the genre, Linda Martell, the first black woman artist to play the Grand Ole Opry back in 1969. I'm joined now by songwriter and producer Alice Randall, the first black woman to co-write a number one country single and the author of the upcoming book, the upcoming memoir, My Black Country, which also has a companion album. It is so great to talk with you, Alice Randall. And so I just want to start by getting your take on all of the sort of contretemps around Beyoncé charting in country. I have to play this. This is John Schneider. He used to be on a show that used to glorify the Confederate flag on a car. Here he is. He's, by the way, he's from New York, but here he is.
St. Texas, ain't no holding.
Oh, we don't have it. Okay, well, I'm just going to read what he said. This is what John Schneider, who used to play one of either Bo or Luke Duke in the Dukes of Hazzard, he said, they've got to make their mark just like a dog in a dog walk park. You know, every dog has to make mark every tree. So that's what's going on here. Would you like to respond to that?
That comment is idiocy. I'll just say that simply. That is an uninformed comment. So African Americans have been in recorded country music since its beginning. It's Women's History Month, so I want to shout out immediately to Lil Hardin. Johnny Cash declared, the great Johnny Cash, that Blue Yodel Number 9 was the most iconic country song of all time. Who played on every bar of Blue Yodel Number 9? Lil Hardin, a black woman. That was 1930. Country itself begins, I believe, with D4 Bailey in 1927 playing Pan American Blues on WSM radio. Black people have been in recorded country since the beginning. And as the brilliant Rhiannon Giddens pointed out, we have been contributing to the form since the form was unrecorded, since it was not before it was recorded.
Yeah, I mean, and creating the banjo kind of makes the black folk a part of country music. You know, it is interesting, the sort of, you know, music is one of the most segregated formats, right? It is extremely segregated. And there was this idea that there's white radio and black radio. Even rock and roll gets segregated. After black folks create it, suddenly, you know, white people will redo it. People like Elvis become superstars from it. But then they segregate it and say, now black people can't do rock and roll. It's a weird thing that happens in the music industry. Why do you think it's still happening now in the 21st century?
It's complex, and that has to do with marketing, because I want to make it very clear that country music, by definition, in my opinion, is a combination of English, Irish, and Scottish ballad forms, plus African-American influences, plus evangelical Christianity. It actually requires African-American influences to be country, or it's folk music. So so those have to do with marketing things. At some point, someone thought they made more money by dividing the audiences. And some people, I think it was part of how race was constructed in America, to divide these audiences. And I think that there has been a kind of cultural redlining that Beyoncé has triumphantly evaded in this moment.
Yeah. It is interesting to listen to somebody, an actor from New York, who pretended to be a Southerner, going after a woman who's literally from Texas and who is a product of the very culture that created country music. She's much more legitimate in the genre than anything he could ever do. So, the audacity of him to comment at all.
I believe everyone, I invite all voices into the conversation, but I will just say that, for example, the Texas, another big Black influence on country and Western music, or a lot of people don't know, I've heard this comment, your costume is not our, don't take our culture, your costume is not our culture. Well, those are people who don't understand that a large percentage of 19th and 20th century cowboys were Black and brown. Yeah. And that actually cowboy culture is significantly African-American culture, and cowboy songs, the 19th century cowboy songs that were discovered, were the first cowboy camp that the Thorpe came across was a Black cowboy camp singing songs. So there are many different ways that Black culture has entered Absolutely. Into country and Western music.
Absolutely. Cowboys were essentially enslaved cattle herders who then went private practice and essentially were doing the same cattle herding they were doing as enslaved people for money. A quarter of them were Black. Alice Randall isn't going anywhere because guess what? It's about to be our favorite part of the week.
Thanks, Joy Reid, for your report on country music and Beyonce, and for Alice Randall as well. But I got to go there, folks, and you know I do. We got to take you back almost, 20 years ago, 24 years ago to be exact, where we talked to a fellow Pittsburgher whose name is Dr. Pamela E. Foster. Dr. Pamela E. Foster is a historical writer and award-winning journalist, having written 3 other books and hundreds of articles about the history of Black people and country music, the history of Holy Trinity Episcopal Church in Nashville, and more. A retired tenured faculty member in the communications department at Tennessee State University, she taught journalism and public speaking for 13 years and advised the Meter newspaper students to the top in their field. She currently teaches research writing at the University of Phoenix and serves as secretary and co-founder of the Nashville chapter of the African American Historical and Genealogical Society Incorporated. A graduate of Smith College and the Middle School of Journalism at Northwestern University. She's a native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who has been living in Nashville for years. And we talked about her an awful lot. We've also had her on the radio in the past. And she also read another book. Okay, it's another book called My Country Too, the Other Black Music, which came out in January 3rd, 2000, in paperback form. Now, this 270-page book is the second ever book about Black people in country music. It includes songwriters, musicians, performers, record label executives, radio station personnel, other key industry players, photos, and a discography of more than 400 entries on the Billboard Country Singles Chart. Okay, as we said, Dr. Pamela E. Foster is an award-winning journalist who lives in Nashville. And once again, I'm going to mention that she is from Pittsburgh. Now, I wrote her asking her about this latest phenomena in country music, and I'll give you my answer from her in just a second. Okay, I was able to find the correspondence I got from Dr. Foster, and this is what he says. This is what she says. Hi, Kevin. Hope all is well. Well, Kev, about Black people and country music, we're always there, always have been, always will be. These are ebbs and flows of mass media attention, which for me are irrelevant to the music as core to our African-American culture. Of course, if the publicity gets others to search and delight in our core, yay! Country music is so much that I find it explains our Black family heritage books. And that's what she's working on right now. She's working on a new book. And she sent me parts of it, which I can't reveal yet because it's not time to release the book. But she did send me some correspondence on her latest project. And I appreciate her listening, and I appreciate her sending me a comment. So good afternoon, Dr. Foster. Thanks for listening to Ebony Spectrum, and welcome back as an almost guest. We were able to share your information with our audience.
We begin the night with representation in country music. It's a highly talked about genre now that Beyoncé is exploring this part of the industry. While artists of color have made strides in the country music industry, we take a closer look at why country artists of color say that's only half the battle. Some of the artists, like the Kentucky Gentleman, were just recognized by BET via an Instagram post. The network is singing a different tune less than 30 days after we asked them about the visibility of Black country artists on their platform. Right now, the network's biggest award show doesn't recognize Black country music artists in any of its categories.
Those spaces don't seem like they're for us. Uh-huh. So I think that this week has shown we belong in every space that we want to belong in. Yeah. Visibility in Black media is important because all stories are important. They all make up this world that we live in. And
I also talked to One the Duo and Breland, the artists already breaking barriers in country music, but they're seeing firsthand the challenges that come with exposure in Black media.
In a stroll through the National Museum of African American Music, country artist One the Duo recognized the celebration of Black artists. But before they can be honored here, they must first win over the fans in the Black community.
It's already an uphill battle being a Black person in this environment. But then also when your own community is giving you the side eye and being like, you're over there. And it's like, not really, though. Not in the way that you would think.
With their connections to the Wu-Tang Clan, they've seen firsthand the support of Black fans for traditional Black genres like rap and R&B. But as they pave their own path in country, they say the perception of the country culture is a barrier.
You are already turned off just because of the stigma that it has, that we're not welcome, or the, let's not get to start and talk about the Confederate flags that might be flying. Don't touch my truck.
Genre-bending artists like Breland say it's tough to change minds.
So you're still fighting both sides.
That's where we're at. trying to get people in the Black community to understand and champion this cause, trying to get people in the white community to understand that I'm not trying to do anything that radical. I just want to be able to pursue a dream.
A dream like being acknowledged by major titans in the Black music industry like the BET Awards. Right now, the award show doesn't include country music. No one from country music has ever won an award or even been nominated. Holly G is founder of the Black Opry. She recognizes how big of a role marketing plays in attracting Black fans.
You know, if you're a Black consumer and you're looking around at which genre you want to land in, it's going to take a lot more effort to want to go to these spaces where you don't feel you're represented in any way.
Those pushing for change say support has to come from the decision makers at the top of Black entertainment, too.
We have to have an executive there who says, hey, this is the category. Here are the hundreds of Black people making country and Americana music in the nation, right? So let's create a marketplace for them to have the light, you know, put on them.
A marketplace where music fans, Black and white, realize they have more in common than once thought.
So like hip-hop and country are really two sides of the same coin, and they're both heavily storytelling genres.
As for the BET Awards, we reached out to them for an interview on the subject. They wrote back asking for more clarification. We responded, and we have yet to hear back. But more artists of color, like Lenny Kravitz and the rock group Living Color, all asking the same question. If you're celebrating Black excellence, what about us?
Country music listening numbers are on the rise, but while Black artists dominate charts across multiple genres, country music is still considered by many to be a predominantly white space. From Johnny Cash to George Strait, Dolly Parton to the Dixie Chicks, why is country music considered so white? First, we should define what country music is. Country legend Harlan Howard famously defined a country song as three chords and the truth.
I love Harlan, but I think that definition misses something.
This is Alice Randall, a New York Times best-selling author, a professor at Vanderbilt University, and a prolific country music songwriter.
I think that country is three chords and four very particular truths.
First truth.
Life is hard.
Second truth.
God is real.
Third truth.
Whiskey and roads and family provide worthy compensations.
And the final truth.
The past is better than the present. To me, those four truths and three chords are what define country.
The black musical influence on the three chords is often acknowledged by scholars, with the roots of country music stemming from the blues and Scotch-Irish music.
One way of defining country music is an Afro-Celtic form. It is black musical influences and Celtic ballad forms that come together to make country.
But what often doesn't get discussed is the role that black artists have had on the four truths.
Sometimes people talk about country as a white space, and I think that misses a point. America is created and seen by many people as a white space. So country seems white because to some people, America seems white. There have always been black people in country music.
There's, of course, Charlie Pride.
Heaven only knows how much I miss her.
There's Ray Charles.
Enter me, and then you say goodbye.
The biggest, most revolutionary country album of all time is arguably Modern Sons in Country and Western Music by Ray Charles. It's Stone Country, and it's Ray Charles.
And then there's what Alice says is perhaps one of the most important country songs in recent memory, Daddy Lessons by Beyoncé.
Daddy's little girl.
You've got the evangelical Christianity, you've got the guns, you've got the sense of the road, you've got the sense of the past, you've got the compensation of family. All the things that we want to see in a great country song are there. Beyoncé is a very important country artist too.
But when Beyoncé performed Daddy Lessons at the 2016 Country Music Association Awards alongside the Dixie Chicks, not all country fans seem to agree.
Beyoncé backlash.
Beyoncé backlash.
Are you saying country is a country club and you don't want us in it?
Whenever we're talking about music, we're always talking about race.
This is Charles Hughes, a music scholar and a professor at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee.
We're always talking about how things sound black or sound white. That is almost always at least a metaphor for what we're thinking about in terms of racial politics throughout the rest of the country. Debates over integration, debates over appropriation and ownership, what whiteness means and white identity means, what blackness and black identity means.
And while country music isn't the only genre where these debates take place,
for several decades at least, if not from the very beginning of country music, country has marketed itself as essentially the soundtrack of white identity, trying to essentially say we're real American music, we're the music of the heartland, we're the music of the silent majority, we're the music of everyday folks, we're the music of rural America or the country people.
This effort on the part of the record industry goes back not just to the beginning of the country music genre, but to the beginning of musical genre itself.
When the record industry created different genre categories to market these new things called recordings, they often did so thinking very specifically about how these particular genres would be marketed towards racial or ethnic specific groups.
Starting in the 1920s, black audiences were sold race records.
Basically, any kind of music that was created by African Americans, blues, gospel, jazz, and other things, that again was thought to be marketed at African Americans, whether they were living north, south, or wherever.
White audiences were sold country music, or as it was originally called, hillbilly music,
a genre that, despite being musically and thematically rooted in the Black American experience, was
very explicitly thought of as being the music of white Southerners or white folks who had recently moved out of the South into Northern or Western cities. The country music is defined, in a sense, by the belief that the folks who will be buying these records and supporting this music will be white folks.
This continued into the present day.
When we're talking about the music, or we're just more broadly talking about those kinds of people and experiences, the assumption has been that those are white folks. Politicians have used country music to try to bolster white conservatism. Record industry leaders have talked about country music as being not just the soundtrack of white America, but as the reaction to soul music or hip-hop or to the civil rights movement, etc.
And yet,
there is no greater demonstration of how much of a lie the idea that country music is white music. There's no greater demonstration of that than the fact that so many folks who are not white love country music, right?
I was born immersed in country music.
This is Caroline Randall Williams, a poet, a professor of blues lyric, and a writer in residence at Vanderbilt University.
In first grade, my teacher, Mrs. Ackerman, said, "Bring your favorite song on a cassette to school." And I brought in, all queued up, George Jones's song, The Grand Tour. Which, if you don't know that song, it's about a man whose wife has taken the baby and left him.
If you'd like to take the grand tour.
And Mrs. Ackerman called my mother and said, "Is everything all right?" I was really just moved by narrative.
For Caroline, the notion of country music as a white space would have seemed peculiar, given that
in my house, country music was black music because a black woman was writing country music in this house.
In fact, not only was country music written in the house,
we're sitting in a house that, to me, country music built.
In part by the hit song X's and O's, performed by Trisha Yearwood and co-written by Caroline's mother, Alice Randall.
This house, bought by the money I made on X's and O's, a song that I'm proud to say has this line, "She's got her God, she's got good wine," Aretha Franklin and Patsy Cline. She's an American girl. My daughter was that American girl.
X's and O's reached the top of the country music charts in 1994, making Alice Randall the first black woman to pen a number one country record. And yet, while Alice realized early on that her daughter Caroline, raised on Aretha Franklin and Patsy Cline in a house built by country songs, is the epitome of country, Nashville might only just now be getting the message.
Darling, looks like he ain't gonna show. But
I knew it was raining, but I didn't see it pour. It was daisies and sunshine. Then you hear the door and now you're shot down. Folks always said booze was no good for me. Jesus always said to love thine enemy. So I hug this bottle. I'm two shots down. Well, he performed the miracle from water. Stronger this time. So pass the bottle, bourbon, and brace for it. Sipping through these scriptures will get me through the worst. I'll get by. Three shots down. I pray to the good Lord for
brand new start. I begged and I pleaded him to mend my broken heart. Thank God you're gone. Four shots down.
Thanks for listening.
I just got a text asking me to approve a bank transfer I didn't make. I bet you get messages like this too. So much of our lives are online today, from email to banking and everything in between. To make sure my information was protected, I checked out CISA's Secure Our World website for simple steps to stay safe online. Now I know how to protect myself from scammers, and you can learn too. Go to CISA at cisa.gov/secureourworld.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Hey there. You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 on your radio, WRCT.org on your web browsing machine. It is 7 o'clock. That means it's time for the radio calendar. Here's some stuff going on in our fair city. Steel City Squares hosts monthly square dances. The next one is happening on March 16th. Then there's one on April 13th. And then there's one on May 11th. So mark your calendar. Dances are beginner and family-friendly traditional Appalachian squares with a live band and caller. No experience is necessary because all dances are taught. Doors and potluck and open old-time jams start at 7. Dances start at 8. All of the dances take place at the Shiloh Center, which is located at 3832 Mintwood Street in Lawrenceville. More information about Steel City Square is on their Facebook page, or you can send some email to squaredancepittsburgh@gmail.com. The Pittsburgh Center for Arts and Media will host a plein air paint out on April 20th and 21st. The two-day event will take place from 12:30 p.m. until 3 o'clock. I'm sorry, 12. Basically noon to 3 on Saturday, April 20th, and from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. on April 21st. En plein air is a French expression meaning in the open air and is used to describe the art of painting outdoors. This new event will utilize its Mellon Park campus to celebrate the art of painting outdoors. The plein air painting experience will be guided by local artists Tyler Gedman and Joshua Hoffman, who will be available throughout both days for questions and advice, like how do you actually pronounce plein air properly. Information and registration for either date is available at pghartsmedia.org/catalog/course. The Space Gallery presents This Is Not a Map, bringing together 8 artists from Carnegie Mellon University's Master of Fine Arts program. Hush up back there. This collection of new works addresses contemporary notions of place, time, and storytelling. Hailing from 5 continents, all now living and working in Pittsburgh, the artists are each presenting an installation informed by their diverse studio practices. Utilizing a broad range of mediums from textiles and collages, to video essays and digital sculpture. The show is on display now through April 28th at 812 Liberty Avenue in downtown Pittsburgh. The Pittsburgh Humanities Festival presents a 5-day festival exploring topics like, can computers understand morality? How do we unlearn the misconceptions surrounding soul food? What really is ASMR, and how can it bring communities together in new ways? Discover the answers to these questions and more as we investigate what makes us all human through a reimagined week of new ideas brought to light. The Pittsburgh Humanities Festival happens April 3rd through the 8th at the Greer Cabaret Theater in downtown Pittsburgh. For more information about this or other things downtown, visit trustarts.org. And you can stop by the Pittsburgh Banjo Club's regular rehearsal every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to enjoy their wonderful music and perhaps have a drink and a beverage. A drink and a beverage, and possibly a snack and a food. Founded in 1988, the Pittsburgh Banjo Club is an all-volunteer band and organization that uses banjos, trumpets, tubas, and bass to perform popular music from the 1920s and 1930s.